Since the Iranian hostage crisis, most of us have become familiar with the term Islamic fundamentalism. In the popular lexicon, it is synonymous with anti-Western religious fanaticism. From time to time, we hear about Islamic fundamentalist uprisings or the threat thereof in places like Algeria, Egypt, or the soft underbelly of Russia and southeastern Europe. But just what is Islamic fundamentalism? Is it the threat to the West that so many seem to portray it as being? Here today, to help us understand and answer these questions, is Professor John Esposito. Professor Esposito is the director of the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University, and the author of the books, Islam, the Straight Path, and The Islamic Threat, Myth or Reality. Welcome to our show, Professor Esposito.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Where at present does Islamic fundamentalism present a threat to U.S. and Western interests?
Well, I really don't think that, in general, that it does. I mean, the first thing is that I have a problem with the term Islamic fundamentalism. I think it's a very monolithic term that covers a vast variety of experiences that exist in the Muslim world. There's an enormous diversity across the Muslim world. I think that where one would be talking a direct threat to U.S. interests would be the extent to which any movement might threaten, for example, oil supply. That's the way the U.S. government would define it. And or the extent to which you would have a terrorist or a terrorist group that were out to attack U.S. interests. And from time to time, we've seen that happen, whether it's overseas or with the World Trade Center bombing. But in general, what we call political Islam or Islamic fundamentalism, except for a minority experience, a good deal of the majority experience is the experience of Muslims who are activists politically and socially within society rather than against society.
Where does Islamic fundamentalism come from? What are its roots?
I think that there are a variety of causes. I mean, in fact, what you have is a contemporary revival of Islam, much as we see a global religious resurgence in terms of Christianity and Judaism and even Buddhism. And some of that has occurred in the last 20 or 30 years. The extent to which Muslim societies have experienced a variety of crises, the 1967 Arab-Israeli war, in which the Arabs were overwhelmingly defeated and lost major territory, Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, all of which have been, as you know, in contention up until today, and a variety of other such crises, the Pakistan-Bangladesh war, the failing of many economies, and also a sense for many, not all, in the Muslim world, that religio-culturally they were losing their identity, the threat of being totally westernized. And there's been a reaction to that, and so for many there's been an attempt to reclaim or re-emphasize religious identity, religious values, religious principles, everything from prayer and pilgrimage to family values.
In your answer to my first question, if I understood you correctly, you suggested that this movement, Islamic fundamentalism, is a good deal more diverse than most of our listeners may have perceived. What forms does Islamic fundamentalism take, and is it always anti-U.S.?
In fact, the phenomenon that we're talking about, there are two distinctions should be made. You've got a revival of Islam. It expresses itself for many Muslims simply in personal life. That is, many Muslims become more devout, more observant. For other Muslims, they not only become more devout and observant, but in fact, part of their belief is that Islam and being a good Muslim should also be reflected in their society and in their state. And so for many of them, they wish to see their religious principles and values implemented more formally in state and society. Now, what that means is that for a significant number of Muslims, it is an attempt within the system to participate, to vote for candidates, to vote more Islamically oriented candidates or parties into power. Socially, it's the creation of clinics and hospitals and daycare centers and legal aid societies that address the social needs of their societies, and they do this believing that they are doing this as good Muslims. For a minority of people, it is the attempt to impose a certain kind of model or paradigm of what it is to have an Islamic state in society. And that minority is at times a minority that has resorted to violence. The problem that we in the West often have is that our experience of the 1.2 billion Muslims in the world, and who are both in Muslim countries as well as here, is not in terms of the majority experience, but more in terms of, if you will, the headline explosive events. And that colors the way in which we perceive what we call Islamic fundamentalism or political Islam. For many Americans, it's seeing it through the lens of the Iranian Revolution and the hostage-taking and then the subsequent hijackings in parts of the Middle East.
Why is it, though, that Islamic fundamentalism is generally portrayed this way as anti-U.S.?
Well, I think that, you know, people generalize from their experience. If you have no background or experience, and you, for example, you don't know anyone who's Irish, and then you meet one Irish person or Irish family or Italian or Polish, you run the risk of generalizing from that experience. If it's very negative, you may presume that all of, quote-unquote, them are like the particular individual or couple that you met. Now, we, for example, those of us of a sort of Judeo-Christian background, when we see an extremist here commit an action, a Christian extremist or a Jewish extremist, or we see it happen, let's say, in Israel, our first reaction is, this is an extremist. This isn't what Christianity and Judaism are about. When Rabin was assassinated, the prime minister of Israel, nobody said, well, that's what Judaism is about. You know, people just said, this is somebody who's an extremist and may have a distorted notion of his or of his religion and use it that way. Because we have a context within which to place it. We understand, roughly speaking, what Judaism and Christianity are about. For Americans who have very little experience of the Muslim world, if their first experience of Islam or the Muslim world was seeing hostages held in Iran and people yelling death to America, the danger is they then generalize that that's what all of them are about.
Is Islamic fundamentalism, or for that matter, Islam as a religion, incompatible with democracy?
Well, I think that Islam is as compatible with political participation, potentially, as any religious tradition. I mean, historically, before the modern period, Judaism and Christianity, the main forms of political forms that they associated with were, in fact, kingdoms and imperial rule and divine right sort of kingdoms. I mean, that's what was legitimated in the name of Judaism and Christianity from biblical times down to the modern period. But then both Judaism and Christianity, when they encountered modern forms of democracy, debated within the traditions to what extent were their religious traditions compatible. And this was, for example, a very clear debate occurred within Roman Catholicism right into the 20th century. Were political participation in democracy and pluralism compatible with Roman Catholicism? And there were many diverse opinions. At the end of the day, in general, believers within both traditions came to believe that modern forms of democracy were acceptable. The same thing is true in Islam and the Muslim world. Muslims are debating to what extent modern forms of political participation and democracy are compatible with Islam. And many Muslims today argue for political participation against often authoritarian regimes. To what extent they will adapt Western forms of democracy is still an open question.
Some have suggested that Islamic fundamentalism is a threat to stability in the Muslim world itself. Do you buy that notion or that argument?
I mean, part of the argument that I would make is that, first of all, again, that one has to distinguish when one talks about Islamic fundamentalism. If we're talking about political Islam, then a majority of movements, if allowed to participate, will participate peacefully within the system. But the minority, the radical minority, it's true, the radical minority are less a threat to the West than they are to the very societies in which they exist. If you have extremists in Muslim countries, their primary target is going to be targets within their own country. The extent to which they will hit a Western target is the extent to which, for example, certain Western governments are seen as supporting regimes that they're against. Then they will attack the embassies of those governments, or let's say the military if they're stationed there, or corporate people if they're stationed there.
What can the United States do to avoid conflicts with Islamic states?
Well, I think that, in fact, the U.S. can treat Muslim countries the way it deals with other countries in the world, and that is that you treat them on a one-by-one basis. You attempt to develop relations with countries that are based not only on what you share in common, but on national interests. The United States, like most countries, has dealings with countries that it shares a lot in common with. It also has dealings with countries that it may not particularly like, but because of national interest, it finds points for cooperation. And I think that ought to be the policy when approaching the Muslim world. The U.S. has had close relations with a number of Muslim countries, such as Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey, and many others. On the other hand, there's no reason why the U.S. can't have relations with countries in which it's primarily based on national interest, and there may be other kinds of tensions between the countries. I think the real thing that the U.S. has to avoid is propping up countries that are unpopular, because when those countries or regimes fall, the U.S. will be seen as having supported a repressive regime, and I think that's the real difficult situation that the United States is sometimes in.
What are the prospects for normalization of relations between the United States and Iran?
Well, I think that the prospects are a lot better today than they were 5 years ago, but I think that we're involved in a very fluid situation. Remember that both the U.S. and Iran have engaged in 20 years of what one might call mutual Satanization. You know, both countries have tended to not only avoid the other, but in fact often condemn the other. Now, in the last year or two, the president of Iran, Mr. Khatami, has in fact called for a civilizational dialogue with the West and with the United States. That's the first step towards political normalization, but I think political normalization is down the line, because a lot still has to be seen. In Iran, you have contending forces, those that wish to normalize cultural and eventually political relations with the West, and those that still remain very adamant in their hostility towards the West. And in the United States, you have a very mixed bag. An administration that wants to move towards normalizing with Iran also has to be aware that it has a Congress to contend with, many of whose members remember the past and are very timid about moving forward into a different kind of future.
In the few minutes we have remaining, let me ask this last question. The conflicts that have been going on in the wars of secession in the Balkans have involved some Muslim peoples, the Bosnians, the Albanians, the Kosovars. What, if anything, or what, if any, role has Islamic fundamentalism played in this region of the earth?
Well, I think the real thing to note is that, if anything, in those conflicts that you're talking about, Bosnia and Kosovo, we are talking about militant Christianity. We are being the problem. We are talking about the fact that there have been there's a tendency within Serbian nationalism to, in fact, also combine a kind of militant Serbian orthodoxy that therefore has justified and legitimated the kind of ethnic cleansing that has gone on. And in fact, often the Bosnian Muslims and the so-called ethnic Albanians, much of their struggle has had little to do with Islam as such or religion as such, and much more to do with issues of autonomy, issues of property, issues of political and economic equity. But in fact, it has often been the more some of the rulers on the Bosnian and Kosovo side have in fact used the kind of militant Christianity to buttress their militant Serbian nationalism.
Professor Esposito, I thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Professor John Esposito, Director of the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University.
We've we've invited religious historian Martin Marty to provide his perspective on Islamic fundamentalism, responding to such questions as, what are the origins of Islamic fundamentalism? What caused it? Does it necessarily lead to militarism or violence? Martin Marty is Emeritus Professor of Religious History at the University of Chicago's Divinity School, where he held the Fairfax M. Cone Distinguished Service Chair and directed the Fundamentalism Project for the American Academy of Arts and Sciences.
Islamic fundamentalism is one version of what today many scholars, mass communicators, and people in the public world describe in the general term fundamentalism. By no means do all Muslims, including Muslim fundamentalists, like that term, because it is imported from the West, from Christianity, from one brand of Protestantism. And so we have to be sensitive if people want to use other words, but whatever words they use, they will be pointing to some phenomena such as the following that I'll now describe. Fundamentalism is born in the 20th century because it's not the same thing as conservatism, traditionalism, or orthodoxy. It is instead a reaction to modernity. First you have to have modernity, then you have fundamentalism. Fundamentalism, under whatever name it goes, is a means of fighting back against some features of modernity. People in traditional cultures feel that the modern world is going to erode and corrode everything they believe in, who they are, what their identity is. And maybe others around them, maybe their own parents, gave up too much. One scholar says that in the Muslim world, many women now are wearing the veil, not because their mother did, but because their mother didn't. Their mother had accommodated, but they didn't get the benefits from that. And so for the sake of knowing who they are and what their power is and so on, they have formed these new groups. Why are they called fundamentals? Because they try to be back to the fundamentals, to the time of the Prophet Muhammad, to the time when the Quran was received, to the time when Sharia, the body of laws, was written. And they believe that by returning to that, they will provide fundamentals which will be the instruments for reacting against the enemy, which may be slack Muslims, it may be secular, militaristic, compromising Muslim regimes, it may be the West, the great Satan, imperialism, the United States, or whatever. However it's done, by selectively retrieving these elements from the past, groups can form that will serve to counter their governments. Most Muslim fundamentalists are fighting their own government and not some other government. And they will give people a meaning and a purpose in life because they believe they are called by Allah to carry on rather militant activity. Fundamentalism doesn't mean that people always have to have guns and shoot others, but it does mean militancy and that there can be no compromise in their literal understanding of what the faith may be. We don't like to psychologize fundamentalists and say that they're just people who can't stand ambiguity or whatever, but they tend to need hard lines, clear definition, and strong motivation to face what they see to be the problems in the world that affect them today.
You've been listening to Martin Marty, Emeritus Professor of Religious History at the University of Chicago's Divinity School and Director of the Fundamentalism Project for the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. This is Talking History.